Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings, folks. Welcome to Media Matters today, Sunday, January 15th, 2006, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a wonderful show for you today on a subject that couldn't be of greater importance, not only in the near term, which it is, but really to the medium and long term here in the United States, around the world, for our species. We all know we're in the midst of a communications revolution, typified and exemplified by the Internet, but going far beyond that. Today we're going to talk about some of the implications of that for our media system and what directions, what the various options are for how this revolution could proceed to make it better or even better serve the people of this country. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Commerce Committee of the United States Senate has an ambitious schedule of hearings on more than a dozen telecommunications policy issues over the next 2 months. The hearings begin this month on topics including decency, video franchising, convergence, and copy protection of digital broadcasts. In February, the committee will hold hearings on network neutrality, public versus private broadband infrastructure, and FCC policy. March will see forums on spectrum reform, rural telecommunications, and more. Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott says these hearings will comprise the majority of public debate on these issues, and in reality, they're just formalities.
The Congress, and particularly the Senate committees, typically call the same stakeholders for the same issues. They like to see the same faces in front of them. They like to generally be able to predict what's going to be said. The debate is known in advance, and they're just articulating the various positions in these hearings.
There are already several pieces of telecom-related legislation in play on many of these issues, and several drafts of wholesale revisions to the Telecommunications Act of 1996 are circulating on Capitol Hill. But Scott does not think 2006 is the year for large-scale changes to the law.
I have heard a lot of analysis in recent months that suggest that such a bill will never see the Rose Garden in a presidential signing ceremony. And so the various stakeholders who want those bits and pieces within the omnibus are going to press very hard to get those priorities taken care of one way or another, and a standalone bill may be the best vehicle.
Many of these issues pit major corporate interests against each other. For example, the concept of network neutrality puts cable and phone companies at odds with computer manufacturers and online firms. Scott says there's opportunity to be found when major special interests square off.
I much prefer to have Godzilla versus King Kong than I do having Godzilla and King Kong on the same team. Because typically what happens when two industry segments brawl over a policy disagreement, that's a scenario where the consumer and the citizen tends to do better, because each side competes to prove that they have integrity riding alongside them, and the way they do that is they make concessions to the public interest.
All told, this national telecom debate is much more transparent than the one conducted in 1996 when the industry dominated the crafting and passage of the Telecommunications Act.
However, we cannot underestimate the power of pay-for-play money in politics in Washington, and it is very difficult to get things done, even if you're right, if you don't have big money on your side.
A new report from the Institute of Medicine produced on behalf of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention blames the rise in childhood obesity and the attendant health problems that come with it on the pervasiveness of junk food marketing in American society. Childhood obesity has more than tripled over the last 40 years. The Institute of Medicine would like to see corporate food and beverage makers develop and aggressively market healthier snacks for kids. If they fail to do this, the Institute suggests the government step in to force the issue, most notably by strictly limiting food and beverage advertising to children on broadcast and cable television. Much junk food marketing can be found in schools. For example, many school districts sign contracts with soft drink makers for market exclusivity and force students to watch Channel 1, a closed-circuit TV network that runs Fluffy News and is sponsored by junk food purveyors. Bob McCannon, Executive Director of the New Mexico Media Literacy Project and co-founder of the Action Coalition for Media Education, or ACME, says schools could help fight the rise in childhood obesity by teaching media literacy skills, helping kids to become better informed consumers. Unfortunately, when the subject arises in a classroom setting, it does not emphasize consumer empowerment.
Most of the media literacy curricula that is being used in schools today is being produced with money from AOL, Time Warner, Viacom, CBS, General Electric, NBC. It's a different kind of media education.
There does appear to be some backlash to the current state of affairs, but media literacy educators say teaching people how to become critical consumers is just half the battle. Showing people how to become media producers, whether it be cut-and-paste flyer collage, blogging, podcasting, or producing a community access cable TV show, helps teach the people that seeking out alternatives to mainstream consumer culture isn't just healthy, but can also be a whole lot of fun.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this Sunday, January 15th, 2006. We have a terrific show, one I've been wanting to do for a long time, concerning the Internet. The effect it has upon our media system in particular and our communication system, and the major policy fights taking place right now globally, nationally, in Washington, D.C., and even at the state and local level, which will really determine what direction this revolution goes in and whose interests it will most serve. And we're very privileged today for this show to have two really terrific guests that I think you're really going to learn a lot from. One guest, they're both joining us, I should say, on telephone from Washington, D.C. area. One guest is Ben Scott, known to many of you listeners as the first producer of Media Matters back in our first year, 2002-2003. Ben Scott is now the policy director for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization, which I helped co-found, to make that clear. And he's also currently a PhD student in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
It's always a pleasure. Our other guest, Mark Cooper, is the research director of the Consumer Federation of America. Mark Cooper holds a PhD from Yale University. He's a former Fulbright Fellow, and he is the director of research, as I said, at the Consumer Federation of America, and he has written numerous reports on media policy, on technology, on the economics of the digital revolution. He's provided expert testimony in over 250 cases. I've had the privilege of getting to know Mark Cooper over the last few years, as has Ben Scott. And it's safe to say there are few, if any, people in the country better versed in these issues than Mark Cooper. Mark, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's really a pleasure to have both of you. Let's start with some basics. We have a general audience on this program, Media Matters. Oftentimes we discuss the quality of journalism. We discuss issues of media ownership. Let's start with some big picture. And Mark, you're probably the best person to handle this one. We've got this Internet revolution. What is it doing to the traditional media system? What effect is it having in the near term? And what are the long-term implications of this revolution?
I've been thinking about we haven't rehearsed this, so I'm glad you asked me that question, because that's what I was thinking about. I want to frame it in the following way. I want to talk about a digital communications revolution. And that revolution is made up of three things. One is the Internet. The Internet's been around for, 35 years or so, in the public for about 20 years. What the Internet let us do was let networks interconnect with each other. That's why it's called the Internet. It was a network of networks. The second key element in this digital revolution was the World Wide Web, which is only 10 years old. People sort of forget how young it is. What the World Wide Web let us do was to share files and add files in terms of their content. it was a common language so that people could actually search, find, and share documents. The third part of the revolution is more recent still, and that's broadband. Broadband is the capacity to move lots of material very quickly. And it took all three of these elements to produce what is, as I think is becoming more and clear to everyone, a digital communications revolution. And the easiest, one of the easiest ways to understand this revolution is the observation offered by Wired magazine in this just this past summer, that 60 to 70% of the content on the World Wide Web is produced by ordinary people, not by corporations, by consumers. And you can't even call them consumers because they're actually producers now. And that, if you look at TV, virtually 0% of the content on commercial TV, for certain, is produced by consumers, by ordinary people. On radio, it may be 10 or 15%. You know those figures better than I, Bob. But the ability of people to produce content and distribute it to wide audiences, made possible by this digital revolution, is what it's about. That is what is breaking upon us now. And for a century, we've been talking about having greater diversity and greater participation. And boy, when it arrives, it just takes your breath away. And that's what's happening. You know, 10 million people are bloggers, right, who are talking to much larger audiences. In this country, 30 or 40 million people read blogs. It's a whole new area of activity that we did not have even 5 years ago.
Now, do you think, Mark Cooper, that we're near the end of this revolution, in the middle, at the beginning? From your perspective, where are we on the bell curve?
It has, and that's why I want to do the history, because I think we're at the very beginning of it. Because if you think about the Internet, that's been around a while. And you think about the web, that's only 10 years old. Broadband is just now deploying. And Ben will tell you how the kind of fights that's why we're getting these fights over broadband and municipal wireless and things like that. This revolution has only just begun. If you pick up your newspaper, you will see somebody thinking about a new way to deliver a new kind of product every day. All the commercial sector is rushing to try and figure out how to keep control over it. But this revolution has only begun. And actually, to put this in historical perspective, as you well know, at the beginning of the 20th century, key decisions were made about the structure of the electronic media. Congress stepped in and asserted jurisdiction and actually cut off a lot of freewheeling, wild, broadcasting in radio when they sort of asserted a certain, they put a certain structure on it, exclusive licenses for companies. Exactly the same kinds of decisions are being made today for the 21st century in these fights over unlicensed spectrum, Wi-Fi networks, network neutrality on the Internet, and I assume we'll get into these things later.
Indeed we will.
But basically, you know, we may be making decisions in the next couple of years that are as momentous as those decisions way back at the beginning of the 20th century. And hopefully the public will be a bit more engaged than they were way back then, right? In part because the public's ability to speak will be determined, and actually the public is finding a voice in these new media.
We're talking to Mark Cooper just now, the research director of the Consumer Federation of America. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Let's turn now to our other guest, Ben Scott, the policy director of Free Press. Ben, if Mark's right, and there's no reason to think he isn't, that we are in the midst, in the early stages of an extraordinary digital communication revolution that's empowering common people to be active participants in the media system, not simply consumers of what commercial interests provide them. Should we even care about issues of, say, media ownership? Is that really relevant anymore if these owners are basically a bunch of dodo birds dorking around us, you know, on the way to oblivion?
Well, they'd like you to think that, Bob. I think, as your listeners are well aware, we have experienced extraordinary consolidation and concentration of power in the radio business and the television business and cable and satellite television. The same companies who control those media sectors are moving quickly to to find ways to take on the Internet. And for 10 years, we've had a sort of free-for-all where 60-70% of the content could be created by regular folks instead of commercial media production centers. But there's a lot of money to be made out there, and the same companies who found ways to control the old media will find ways to control the new media if we're not careful and we don't make good policy decisions. And a large part of the way they do it is they leverage the ownership that they already hold over the old media. So if you've got a lot of content under your umbrella or you've got control over a network, you can use that to grab power in the new media environment. And I think, as an aside, even though we're doing a show on the Internet and new media, it's important to note that, you know, we haven't yet thrown broadcasting into the dustbin of history. Broadcasters still hold tremendous power, and tens of millions of people still get their news and culture from television and radio. They're still very, very important, and even though we'll be talking about how important the Internet will become, it's important to maintain a balance and understanding where we are on that curve.
We're talking to Ben Scott and Mark Cooper today in Media Matters. If you want to call in with your questions or comments, the number here is 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And lines are open. Please do call in. Ben, you know, okay, granted these current stakeholders, the media owners, have a lot of political power. They have a lot of influence over society and a lot of economic power. But it sounds, listening to Mark Cooper talk, like, I mean, this revolution is like a tidal wave. I mean, ultimately, it's just a matter of time until this technology blasts all of them out of the water. I mean, what is going to prevent there from being a truly democratic digital communication system with this extraordinarily powerful technology?
Well, you're talking like an academic, Bob, which I suppose I shouldn't blame you for.
No, that's not really an insult.
I hear that a lot from academics, and we heard it in the mid-90s, that the technology would set us free and there was a certain inevitability to the Internet. And I think that that academics and technologists really misunderstand the way the policy process works. And though it may be that a technology has some inevitable drive toward a certain end, policy making and the power behind the policies can delay that technology for generations. We may not see the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if we don't make good policies in the interim. And let me take a good example of that. Mark mentioned earlier that the fundamental revolutionary nature of the Internet was the drop in cost of distribution. You can produce your own content and you can send it out to millions of people on the Internet literally for free or for a couple of 10, 15 bucks a month for your connection. Now, let's say I'm a network owner. And I own lots of content, or I've made deals with content producers. Why in the world should I let everyone continue to distribute their content for free? Why shouldn't I get in there and discriminate? Why shouldn't I say to you, you know, Bob, if you want to stream Media Matters on the Internet, and I'm the network owner, I'm AT&T, well, that's going to cost you X number of dollars a month. Let's say $10,000 a month. And you say, well, you know, WIL is not a rich station. We don't have $10,000 a month. Well, then I'll say to you, Bob, too bad. We're going to stick you in the slow lane of the Internet. We're going to put you in a place where, you know, consumers can still listen to your show, but the connection is spotty, and there's going to be no guarantee that your radio stream will reach its audience. That's the nutshell of the debate over what's called network neutrality.
And this is not a hypothetical or academic debate, if I understand it.
Oh, yeah, you read the Wall Street Journal tomorrow or yesterday, and you'll find the big network owners talking about exactly that. They call it names like tiering and maintaining quality of service. But what it means is discrimination in a business model.
Yeah. You've been listening to Ben Scott. Now, Mark Cooper, I know you've written a lot about this. This also pertains to the Brand X case, yeah, the big Supreme Court case. Tell folks, if you would, a little bit about that case last spring, what it was about, why it was so important, and what the implications are for this network neutrality.
Well, Ben's absolutely right. Well, I think technology is very potent. There's no doubt that the incumbents, telephone companies, cable companies, Hollywood studios, even big software companies like Microsoft, they really have an interest in controlling disruptive technologies. So Larry Lessig likes to talk about if the dinosaurs could legislate the environment, the mammals never would have won. They are determined to assert and maintain control over this environment. And so, in each of the major decision areas we now have, policy could really make it hard for people to speak, just like that policy in 1927 made it impossible for average citizens to have radio stations. And Ben puts his finger on one principle. Since 1910, actually, when the Congress passed the law, the telephone network was subject to obligations of non-discrimination in interconnection and carriage.
What does that mean in regular language?
Well, what that means, and I'm about to tell you what it means.
Good.
Because basically, the patent on the telephone had run out in about 1897, and independent phone companies start to pop up now that they had access to the technology. And actually, this is a good principle of making good ideas available after a period of time. So the independent phone companies started to serve small cities that had been bypassed, particularly in the Midwest where you're located. What was the reaction of AT&T, the Bell system? They simply refused to interconnect with those independent companies so that each independent company was an island, unable to reach the rest of the nation. And, of course, that outraged people in the Midwest, and there was a rebellion, a populist rebellion. I said, wait a minute, we can't run our national communications network this way. Interestingly, the Bell system in a famous commitment in 1909 said, hey, you know what, we now believe in universal service. For them, it meant one system interconnected and open. And interestingly, notwithstanding that promise, the next year, the Congress passed a law that said you have to interconnect and let people talk to each other. That is the environment in which the Internet was born. The Bells, AT&T, looked at this new way of communication, of handling traffic, and they said they didn't want any part of it. They were a centralized network subject to obligations of non-discrimination, and the Internet principle was a broader open principle. And they kept resisting it, and ultimately the Federal Communications Commission, we always hear evil things about the bad stuff they do, a famous set of inquiries called the computer inquiries said, no, the baby bells are not going to be allowed to monkey around with what was then computer traffic, data traffic. And in that space where the data networks were treated in a non-discriminatory fashion, that's where the Internet grew up. Unfortunately, after the 96 Act, the cable guys got into the Internet business. And their system had always been a closed system. Actually, it had been a closed system since 84. And so when they started selling Internet service, a debate came about whether the communication services that they were selling to the public as part of their Internet service should be treated as a cable service in which it was closed and proprietary and they could do what they want, or should be a telecom service in which had to be governed by the rules of non-discriminatory interconnection and carriage. That case was went on for years and years.
Mark, can I interrupt for just 1 second so our listeners can get a sense of what's at stake here? Why would the cable company, you know, the phone companies are letting anyone who wanted to use their wires to be online could get connected without discrimination. They didn't have to pay an extra fee. The cable companies didn't want it. Why didn't the cable companies want to do that? What's in it for them to have a different type of private system where they monitor things?
Well, the primary reason, and we have, you know, if you look back at the evidence, was they didn't want competition for video. Let's be clear. The cable guys have a dominant position in video programming.
TV is another way to put it.
TV, that's right. That cable system is they pick and choose the programs that go through their wires. They exercise that control. And they were not about to deploy a high-speed Internet. And remember, I started from the revolution of high speed, very important here, mm-hmm. because video needs that speed to be useful. They were not about to deploy a system in which they could not control competition for video services. And so they asserted, and in the early days they had all kinds of speed limits and things, so that anything that looked like it was a stream of video that might compete with their service,
mm-hmm.
they were not going to let them go. And those were in the original user agreements. Because they were protecting their main line of business. And we have discovered the documents in which the developers of the technology said, oh, you can engage policy-based routing. That is, you could literally slow down your competitors and speed and make sure your own stuff works. So they asserted that they were not a telecom service, and we had now had a series of court cases. And finally, last year, the Supreme Court supported allowed that to go forward. It's not, and this was an administrative law decision, saying that the FCC had the authority to redefine the communication service offered by cable operators in this fashion.
It didn't require them to do so; just said they had.
That's right, and it didn't necessarily say that was the right public policy decision. But under administrative law procedure, since Congress, you know, wasn't precise and the agency is the expert agency, they get deference.
So politically, if we organize sufficiently the people of this country, we could get a different administrative law ruling.
Absolutely. This is not you could get a public policy ruling.
Okay.
You could pass a law that said, no, the principle of non-discrimination, which has worked so well for almost exactly 100 years, ought to be imposed on everyone who provides these kinds of communication services. So we could go back and rewrite that law. That's known as the Brand X case. Brand X was a small, very effective internet service provider, had 40 or 50,000 customers at the time, who could not get access to the cable system. Cable operators simply would not let them use their pipes to sell services. Brand X didn't want a free ride. They just wanted a fair price for transmission to the customer. They couldn't get it. They sued. We've had this series of decisions and court cases. And right now, and then the FCC, once it won on the cable side, immediately moved to allow the telephone companies to abandon the principles of non-discriminatory interconnection and carriage. And that's where we stand today, with a couple of exceptions. In approving the recent mergers of AT&T, SBC, now AT&T, or MCI, Verizon, the commission actually imposed a condition of non-discrimination as a condition of the merger. The commission adopted a principle of non-discrimination, but immediately said it was unenforceable. I mean, unenforceable principles aren't very meaningful to most people, and that's why we still have a ferocious legislative fight about this network neutrality.
We're talking to Mark Cooper, the Research Director of the Consumer Federation of America, and Ben Scott, Policy Director of Free Press, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the internet, the digital communication revolution, and the fundamental political fights taking place right now that may go a long way towards determining exactly what type of communication revolution we're going to have. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Media Matters, the number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been very patient. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Scott and Cooper.
Hello. I guess I have two questions, perhaps a little naive. The first one is, who, if anybody, owns the internet? And the second one is, from both a technical and legal standpoint, I'm interested in the extent to which the internet can be controlled, I guess both in terms of censorship of content and access to the internet and the ability to charge money for that access.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Who wants to go first, Ben? Mark?
Sure. Go ahead. Mark, you want to go first?
Yeah, let me try. I mean, no one owns the internet. That's for sure. The internet is a series of codes, of protocols that enables traffic to be handed between various networks. And so, no one owns that protocol. And it turns out that's a historical accident about how it got developed. And a firm commitment, interestingly, by the government and research institutions to keep it open. Just a bit of history: the World Wide Web was brought into existence and accelerated when someone, it turns out, a university, threatened to start trying to collect royalties for a particular way of sharing files. Some people thought that that was a big mistake. They preferred open communication. So, in fact, if we look back over the history, at key junctures, there are big fights about keeping this system open. In that sense, the answer is nobody owns the internet.
But we're having another one of those fights right now.
Absolutely. What people do own, however, is the transmission system, the medium, the wires, or in the case of spectrum, the wireless frequencies. People either own or assert the right to control the use of those media to carry your message to the Internet, which is this big cloud where it gets exchanged and handed off. And that's where things become a little bit more dicey. If you live in rural Illinois, you may have only one company capable of delivering, of giving you a high-speed Internet connection. They own that connection. It might be a DSL line. And they can then, under the new ruling, say, we want to charge you X, or we won't let you get Y kind of service, or we're going to charge anyone who tries to sell you a particular kind of service more, as Ben had pointed out, in order to get that service to you. So it's in the ownership control of the transmission medium that matters. And let me make another point. In the mid-90s, when the web first came into existence, there were browsers out there, and you may recall a famous battle. Microsoft looked at the browser and knew that would be a key tool for accessing the Internet, and they tried to exercise a proprietary control over how Internet browsers would get used and be deployed. Famous court case, which they lost, right? So that even though there are no one owns the Internet, they can own key pieces, key tools necessary to gain access to the Internet, to use the Internet. And let me add the third piece in, and this gets us to Bob's long-standing area of interest, the content providers, right? The content providers who own the TV shows or the music albums, the recordings, they would also like to assert control over that content to dictate how you can listen to it, whether you can share it, which devices will it play on, right? Each one of these instances, someone is trying to leverage, to use their control over either the conduit, the pipe, the software, the browser, or the content, to use their control over that to dictate how consumers can use it and actually to restrict consumer choice in what they do with their content.
We had a long show about copyright last week with Professor Kimbrew McLeod. Mark, I want to turn back to Ben and go into this issue of net neutrality again, because it's come to this now throughout the first half of the show. Ben, I mean, as I see net neutrality, the way you've explained it to me off air, the idea is that the big cable companies that provide, and the phone companies that provide the broadband access for the vast majority of Americans today, will have multiple tiers where there are some people pay them a lot more money, the Googles and Yahoos, for example, and their websites will beam through very quickly at super high speeds, and other people who aren't willing to pay that amount of money basically are in the margins with sort of a dirt road.
That's the broad outlines. Let me put it into practical terms. Let's say I'm a student at the University of Illinois. I've got an apartment in Champaign, and I've got a DSL line. I'm paying $29.99 a month for my 1.5 megabits of service. And once I put in my $30 a month, I can go to any website I want, and every website will download at exactly the same speed. And anytime I want to upload content by sending an email or posting a file, it'll go up at exactly the same speed. What the phone companies are saying now is, hey, you know, the days of that free ride, and when they say the days of the free ride, they mean 100 years of communications policy, ever since the 1909 decision to make the phone network open.
And they don't mean their free ride. They mean everyone else's.
Yeah, they say, you know, we built this network, and no one should expect to travel on it for free. And so they're looking at all these companies like Google, who's very famously recently seen their stock price explode, and a bunch of the other Internet companies, and they see lots of dollar signs. And so they want to say, look, you can pay you $30 a month, but then we're going to go around to all the content providers and all the service providers, and anybody who wants to pay us a fee, an extra fee, we'll speed up their websites. And that'll be an extra source of revenue for us, and it'll end the free ride. And it's all fair because these are all rich companies and they can afford it.
Go ahead.
What that does is it sets a really ugly precedent of first and second class citizens on the Internet. Those who can pay the fee to be in the fast lane, and then everybody else in the slow lane. And what it will ultimately produce is two things. One is all consumers will know, well, these are the fast sites, and they will have an enormous competitive advantage. And it will be very, very difficult for innovators and entrepreneurs to build new ideas on the Internet and launch them because they won't have the money to pay the fee to get in the fast lane right off the bat. So no one will ever find them.
Now, is this, I got to interrupt you, is this justified technologically? I mean, is there some shortage of ability to provide equal access at high speeds to people?
Not at all. And in fact, discriminating is much more difficult technologically than having an open platform.
All right. Well, let's go back. Ben,
let me chime in here. Cause
yeah, please really do, Mark Cooper.
Yeah, because there's another simple way to think about it. One of the things they like to say is, you know, why should Google be able to use the telephone network, the communications network, without paying for it? But the irony, of course, is that Google doesn't use the telephone network. I use the telephone network. See, that view sees the world as only as the traditional producers, right? Essentially, if I want to get something from Google, I'm the one who uses the network. I'm the consumer. Google can't knock on my door and say, "Here, take this." I have to decide to click on Google's website, to click on Amazon's website. So I'm the consumer, and for 100 years we've always let the consumer be sovereign here. This is known as consumer sovereignty. So we had one decision, and the telephone company charged the consumer a price. And there were, in fact, different kinds of services, right? I could have measured service. I could have flat rate service. Recently, I could have DSL service or narrowband service. In the old days, I could get a T1 line. I can still get a T1 line, right? I could ask for a much higher level of service if I was willing to pay for it. But then anything that fit within that category of service, right, would work. They were not allowed to say, wait a minute, Google stuff isn't allowed to go into it on a T1 line. And Ben points out a couple of problems with it. The one problem is, of course, the Bells and the cable guys will be selling those services too. So what as well, right? So if Google starts to say, hey, you can stream video, Cooper, if you want it, I can go to the Google site and get video, or I can go to the Verizon site and get video. What will happen is that by making service providers pay into the telephone company coffers, they're restricting the amount of competition for those services. The other problem, of course, is that what happens to the next Google? Who can't afford to pay the very, very high price for this high-speed Internet. That source of innovation, which has been so important in the Internet age, the students, all of those people who are outside will not be allowed to get in. That's why the old system of let the consumer pick a level of service they want and then let all these providers who can dream up applications fill those pipes up. We've never had a problem filling the pipes up in the last 20 years.
You've just listened to Mark Cooper, the Research Director of the Consumer Federation of America, speaking. He's my guest today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in Media Matters. Our other guest is Ben Scott, the Policy Director of Free Press. We're talking about the future of the digital communication revolution, the Internet, and the crucial policy issues that will affect the shape of the Internet in the future. We've spent a lot of time so far in the program talking about this issue of net neutrality, whether we'll have what they call a tiered Internet with sort of a fast lane for the big guys and a dirt road for everyone else. Ben Scott, real quickly before I get back to the phone lines, tell me, right now in Washington, is there a play on this issue that our listeners should be following? And if they want to follow it, what should they do?
Absolutely. And this is one of the hottest issues in the Congress right now, with the big phone companies and cable companies together fighting against the consumers and every content service provider on the Internet. And it is under the umbrella of a big package of legislative proposals, which is called telecom reform or the Telecom Act. You'll hear it called lots of different things. But it will be moving in the Congress this year for certain. And anyone who wants to get involved can go to the Free Press website at freepress.net. We have a variety of materials on it, and we'll have a very in-depth page on the issue of network neutrality, which will be brand new next week. So we'll watch our site for that popping up.
People want to call in to speak with Ben and Mark on today's show. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, thanks for your patience. You're on the air with Scott and Cooper.
Hello. My name is Sean Mine. I'm a professor in electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois. Actually, we do a lot of research and trying to improve the technological side. I have two questions. The first one's quick, just about Skype and other programs like that that are aiming to take over the telecommunications industry. I mean, I know that I have a friend who regularly calls Yugoslavia for free through the Internet, and I know that's going to shake things up and probably lead to legislation. That's question one. And question two is, coincidentally, in On the Media, the program that's just before this, there was a Harvard law professor, I believe, who wrote a book called Without a Net, and he was advocating that there's going to have to be a new Patriot Act for the Internet to try to limit who can write code and how people use the Internet. And he was arguing this because of viruses. And I just wondered if you had any comments on this. It seems to me, you know, exactly what we're all fearing, that this is the sort of thing, the kind of premise that might be used to put more control on the Internet. So if you have any comments, I'd be very, very curious.
Thank you very much. And, you know, Mark and Ben, before you answer those two excellent questions, we didn't answer the first question, the part two of the last caller, about can the Internet be controlled by a government? Could the United States government start censoring material so that a website just can't be seen by anyone in the United States?
Actually, some states have tried that, and the state of Pennsylvania ordered Verizon to shut down a particular website for making offensive material available, and the whole state lost all of its connections to Spain, as I understand it. It's a difficult thing. Obviously, you can try and identify individual sites through internet addresses and deal with them. Ultimately, I mean, the technical and legal questions are become completely intertwined. In a democratic society such as ours, I mean, order depends upon the voluntary compliance of the vast majority of people with the law of the land. So it is possible for people to hack through an attack, and the vast majority of people either don't try, don't have the skill to. And, you know, law and order is a function of law and enforcement and compliance and voluntary compliance. So it's easy to say that, you know, it's easy to say that technology can or can't do certain things. And, in fact, that's probably always been the case, and we lay law on top of that to build the kind of society we want. And it may get a little more complex when technology is potent, but in the end, it's law and social institutions on which social order rests.
Well, let's go to the most recent caller's questions. The first one, Ben Scott, dealt with Internet telephony. You know, the fact that with the Internet now, the traditional costs of making a long-distance telephone call have gone from whatever they used to be to approaching zero. How does this factor into what we've been talking about?
Well, as you might imagine, the phone companies who are serving up their DSL lines and having people use Skype, they're not crazy about that idea because it cuts directly into their bottom line. Instead of picking up the phone and spending 80 cents a minute to call Yugoslavia, you can go online and use Skype for free. Well, the logic of the market will tell us that it's not going to be too long before the phone company is going to figure out a way to charge Skype for that privilege and try to force them to pass those costs along to you, the consumer, using that Internet telephony service. I do imagine that they will go to the Congress and try to get some regulatory authority to do that and slap Internet telephone service providers with the same kinds of regulatory restrictions as your packet switch telephone network uses. And it's a really, I think, an insidious logic for these phone companies to say, well, look, we're not charging the consumer anymore. We're not laying the burden on the consumer. We're laying the burden on the service providers, the Skypes, the Googles, the Amazons. But let me put this in a nice metaphor that I think works. We all are familiar with the electric system. Imagine that you and your house, Bob, probably have Illinois Power. And you got a Black & Decker toaster on your counter. Imagine that Illinois Power went to Black & Decker and said, if you want your toaster to work, you're going to have to pay a fee. And once you pay the fee, we'll go ahead and let your toaster work. And you can more, if you want your refrigerator to work, we're going to have to get a fee from you. Well, those companies, Black & Decker and Kenmore, just like Google and Amazon and Skype, are not going to be able to tolerate those fees too long before they go ahead and pass the costs along to you. So the cost of your toaster is going to go up, the cost of your refrigerator is going to go up, the cost of your Skype phone call, your Amazon purchase, and your Google search are going to go up. And that's the end result that really hurts the consumer and the reason why we have to be very, very vigilant on this debate.
Well, Ben, just I want to follow up. This is such an important point. What about the argument these phone companies and cable companies will make that, hey, they're free market companies, they've won in the marketplace, and they're just instituting marketplace logic, and they deserve to have this power because this is a free society?
Well, that they will conveniently never mention the fact that in the case of the phone companies, a lot of the build-out of the phone networks was paid for out of public subsidies. And in the case of both the phone companies and the cable companies, they lay their wires along the public streets and on public telephone poles and light poles, and they get that privilege by making agreements with local governments. They have their monopoly market at our leave, and we, because they use our public rights of way, we have the ability to regulate their service. It always has been, and hopefully always will be.
Mark Cooper, let's go to the second question the caller had about the Harvard professor's book, Without a Net. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with the book. I'm certainly familiar with the argument. I suppose the fear of a flu pandemic should shut down all the airlines in the world. I mean, you know, if it's true that the pandemic is moving from west to east, and so one solution is to simply say, don't let airplanes or people move or products move. I mean, I think the real answer is that, and I started to get at this before, people who don't build systems that are immune to viruses should be liable for those viruses, and they may not be in our world. But the immense value and benefit of having this communication is just too large to say, well, you know, we can't solve the virus problem, and so let's shut it all down. So the answer is to build a system that's resilient, responsible, and sometimes we don't lay responsibility in the right places. The net benefit, I think, is large. Let me go back to the first one for two points.
Okay.
Ben's analogy to the toaster was real interesting. First, let's be clear. Anyone who has Skype already is paying for an internet connection, right? They have a broadband connection. And what Skype is, and so if you, in Ben's example, you're paying $30 in champagne for a DSL line, the telephone company is getting that $30. What Skype is, an application that runs over those wires for which you have already paid. So now, is it eating into the long distance business? Absolutely. But if the cost of delivering a long distance call over a paid-for network, a DSL line, is in fact zero, then you know what? That long-distance business shouldn't be commanding any dollars anymore. So let's be clear. This is not a free ride. The customer has already paid for it. Skype has developed a really neat application. And we don't want a system that doesn't let the smart guys at Skype think of new applications or Google or other places. That's one point. The second point, Ben's toaster is real interesting because it really lets us understand the three components I mentioned before. He talked about the electricity company having the ability to require you to pay them so that their electrons would work with your toaster. We might think about the toaster as the internet browser, and imagine if the toaster company had a monopoly or close to it and said, look, you know what? Until you get the code from me, this toaster won't work. And then just to add the content part of it, imagine Hollywood being able to say, my bread won't go in your toaster, or your toaster won't be able to cook my bread without my permission. That's sort of the simple way of seeing how each of these entities is trying to exercise control over your choice. A lot more complex than that, but that is a real good, simple way to understand what the stakes are here.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today, January 15th, 2006, here in WILL AM 580. Our guests, Ben Scott, the Policy Director of Free Press, and Mark Cooper, Research Director of Consumer Federation of America, who you've just been listening to. Before we get back to the phone lines, I do want to we had a couple people emailed questions and comments in. One person emailed in to say that Ben Scott had been, if anything, understated the quality and extent of accessible material on the www.freepress.net website, where there's a great deal of material answering all the questions we've raised in this program and also going into even more detail on community internet, something we wanted to talk about today's show, but we have yet to get to it because we've had so much to talk about in this massive issue. The second caller, and maybe this is one that you can field, Ben Scott, a second emailer, inquired, how is the regular news media covering these issues that we're talking about on the show? Ben?
Well, if you read the business sections of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, hey, they're covering it a lot. If you are watching television news, cable television news, listening to the radio, with the exception of programs on stations like WILL, you're not going to get much of it at all. A lot of contemporary journalism thinks of these stories as too dull and complex and uninteresting to the commercial market, which is a shorthand for not approved by the advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're dependent on the mainstream news, you're not going to get this debate at all. And that's one of the fundamental problems that I am, set upon trying to fix. That's what Free Press does. We watch these important debates and try to popularize them, because if we don't do it, it ain't going to get done.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines right now to a very patient caller. Line one, White Heath, you're on the air with Scott and Cooper.
Thank you. I don't know if this is going to relate to what you're talking about, but I'm concerned that the telecommunications business has been involved with wiretapping and looking into private citizens' emails and all that to help out the government, and I wonder if you could discuss that or if that doesn't pertain to your discussion today.
Well, if I can interject, we're going to make it pertain because that's such an important question, and I know that both of our guests are very interested in issues like that. Let me phrase that another way or put another element to the question for either of you or both of you, Ben and Mark. We're often told that having private control over our telecommunications and media system is a great protection for the population from government censorship or government spying, government intrusion upon our lives. Mark Cooper, has that been the case? Have the phone companies and cable companies been a bulwark to protect the privacy of individuals from government intervention and intrusion?
No. Well, it's not the technology. Let me make that's, I think, the most important thing to understand is that, whatever technology we use to communicate, if government wants to eavesdrop or listen, they will bring force to bear, in pressure to bear, and do it. When we even have legislation, which when the government looked out at the internet and they said, "Hey, wait a minute, we're not going to be able to hear, we're not going to be able to oversee, we're not going to be able to listen," they made the phone companies put in the necessary elements so that they could continue to do that. So the answer is, any technology can be used or abused in this fashion. We're now told, and we've read about in the paper, that the phone companies were asked to disgorge this information in a massive eavesdropping process, a project, and they did. That's the human beings, folks. That's not the technology that is making that kind of decision. And yes, there is no ironclad technological protection from that kind of action by public or private entities who want to try and obtain the information.
Ben Scott, we've been talking a lot on this entire show, and now, regrettably, we've only got about 5 minutes left, but we've been talking a lot about the phone companies and the cable companies being the controllers of access to broadband for American business into American households, for American institutions. and that this is simply the way it is and how they're using their duopolistic control, so to speak, to gain as much power and profit as possible, oftentimes maybe not at the for the benefit of the American people or our future. But they aren't the only option, are they, before us? And I know in other programs on Media Matters, and people in the Champaign-Urbana community are well aware of this, there is another course that communities around the country are adopting to deal with broadband access, which is called Community Internet. Could you briefly describe what that is, and then in our short period of time, just talk a little bit about what the fights are to make that possible?
Sure. Well, it's pretty simple, especially in rural America, and 10 miles outside of Champaign-Urbana qualifies instantly. Broadband is a lot of times simply not available. About 20% of the households in the country, they can't get broadband even if they wanted it at any cost. And in many of our cities, $30 a month is outside the budget of a family of four, or family of two for that matter. So a lot of communities have decided, well, can we provide broadband services to our citizens at a lower cost if we, you know, do so without looking for a 50% profit margin, and we do so with a public service motive? And lo and behold, they could, and they could do it using wireless technologies. And it's basically just another way to bring an internet connection to a home. It is very inexpensive because you don't have to dig up the streets to lay the wires. And they have figured out ways to bring internet access to people for $10 a month, $5 a month, and, you know, there are some ideas of how to bring it for free.
Now, is this the sort of clunker dirt road internet access because it doesn't come from a wire?
Not at all. And in fact, wireless technologies are developing very, very rapidly and in many cases can bring the same or better quality of service as a wired connection. And Champaign-Urbana is at the cutting edge of wireless technologies. Lots of research going on at the university and a community group in Urbana. The Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network has built out a network in the neighborhood in Urbana, and I believe they're about to move into downtown Urbana here in the next 6 to 9 months, which is a very exciting development. But I think the bottom line here is wireless community internet uses the public airwaves. If we really wanted to bring broadband internet access to every home in America at a reasonable cost, $5 a month, $10 a month, we could do it tomorrow, but we'd need the policies to make it happen. We'd need to open up the public airwaves, the people's most valuable resource, and use it to deliver communication services. It would be a fantastic development for us. It's opposed, of course, by the cable companies and the phone companies that are making billions of dollars on internet access, but it's available to us, and all we need is the political will to organize around it.
Now, where are these fights taking place? Is this in Washington, D.C., or is it the state and local level?
It is taking place in Washington, but it is a fight that's happening at the state level. Just next door in Indiana, the state government has a bill pending that's just cleared the Senate in Indiana that would prohibit a city like Urbana from partnering with a local nonprofit or even a local private business to bring cheap internet access to its citizens. Now, let me say that again because I think it's outrageous. A state is passing a law to prohibit a community from delivering the services to its citizens that they need.
Now, why would they do this? That seems crazy.
Well, they do it because very powerful and well-financed corporate interests are backing those bills.
I'm shocked to hear that. Mark Cooper, we've only got about a minute, not even a minute and a half left. Why don't you weigh in, if you would, on really, if you were to have a minute to tell or 45 seconds to say what you think people, listeners, should be doing on this issue, what would you say?
Well, this last one is, I think, the most important one. In Washington, D.C., 80 years ago, the government asserted control over the spectrum and gave licenses to broadcasters, made them gatekeepers for 80 years, took away my right to speak. They took away the broadcast rights of every American citizen. This year, 80 years later, we're having that same fight again, fighting for more spectrum, for unlicensed uses to let people speak. If we win that fight, it will change the structure of our free speech environment for generations, as Ben said. That is the single most important fight. If we can get more spectrum, and then we'll go state by state. The absurd idea of having states say localities can't build what I consider basically the subway system. That is, it may not be the fastest. It'll be perfectly fine. A subway system carries millions of people, gets them to and from work, does basic things for them.
Mark Cooper, I'm afraid the band is tuning up in the background. They're about to throw me out of the studio. Let Tavis Smiley get in here. Mark Cooper, Research Director of Consumer Federation America, Ben Scott, Policy Director of Free Press. Thank you both very much for joining me, Bob McChesney, today in Media Matters. I want to thank Andrew Aboyo, my producer, Brett Polson, Technical Director, and I'll see you 1 week from today.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located next to the post office, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the mid-40s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain, the high in the lower 50s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.